Do you play well with others? Do you get along with your coworkers at work and all work together in a happy way, and at the end of each day you link arms and sing Kumbaya? Yeah, right. Working with other people is probably the least favorite part of many people's day, and yet it's a very, very important skill, and or maybe it's even a gift. In fact, David O. Stewart, a lawyer and author and historian, thinks it's an amazing gift, and he thinks that it was a gift that defined the father of our Constitution, James Madison. So he's written a book, and strangely enough, the title of that book is Madison's Gift, and he talks all about the five partnerships that defined Madison's life. And guess what? I talked with David Stewart, and now I'm going to talk with you. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about Madison's Gift.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional, produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Constitutional Law Professor Stuart Harris.
If you're a regular listener, you may have heard our older show. It's called Aaron Burr's Big Adventure, and it's all about what happened to Aaron Burr after the interview at Weehawken, after he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton. It's a fascinating tale, and it was told in a very good way by a lawyer and historian by the name of David O. Stewart. He wrote a book on it some years ago called American Emperor, and I interviewed David a couple of years back, and it's a fascinating episode, and it's available on iTunes, and I hope you'll listen to it, but that's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is another book by David Stewart that came to my attention in a sort of roundabout way. I was in Richmond recently, and I was filming some video segments for a new online course on the origin of the Constitution that the Center for the Constitution, the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at Montpelier, will soon be launching, so stay tuned for that. But at any rate, there were a whole bunch of other authors and scholars who were there, and among the people was David O. Stewart, because guess what? His latest book is about James Madison. Now, you might think that there's been so much written about James Madison over the years that there's nothing new to be learned. Well, you would be wrong. There are many different ways to look at this multifaceted father of our Constitution. And the way that David has chosen is to look at Madison's gift for partnership. You see, Madison seemed to live by the maxim that you can get a great deal done if you don't worry about who gets the credit. And I think it was that humility, that persistence, that good humor, that quiet working behind the scenes that is responsible for many of the remarkable things that Madison was able to accomplish.
I'm David O. Stewart. I write books, mostly about historical books, fiction. It's something I've just started doing with a couple of historical mysteries, but I've also written several American history books, beginning with the summer of 1787 about the writing of the Constitution and moving up to the book coming out right now, Madison's Gift, about James Madison.
David, you are far too modest. You represent the highest aspiration of almost every lawyer I've ever spoken to. And that is to stop practicing law and instead to write cool books.
Well, you're very generous.
We spoke some time ago about one of those books, and it was about Aaron Burr. In fact, if anyone wants to listen to that podcast, it's up on our website. It's on iTunes as well. And it's called Aaron Burr's Big Adventure. Just give us a quick recap of that one to whet people's appetite.
Well, that was about Burr's Western expedition, which was after the duel with Hamilton, and he left the vice presidency in early 1805. He was really ruined politically, and the question was, what is he going to do? He was only in his late 40s. And he contrived this scheme, which historians have scratched their heads over for years, centuries now, which ended up appearing to me to have involved essentially creating a new nation with Aaron Burr at the head of it, out of our Western territories and liberated Spanish lands, Texas, Mexico, and Florida. So it's quite an adventure tale that ends up involving a lot of constitutional law as well, because he got tried for treason. So it was an amazing episode.
And an amazing book, and though the title of the podcast is Aaron Burr's Big Adventure, what's the actual title of the book, in case people want to get that?
American Emperor.
and an appropriate title, because after reading it, I thought to myself, that's the closest we've ever come to Napoleon in this country.
Other than having the Corsican come over himself, you're right.
All right, David. I also have to mention that I was prompted to call you up today because you and I just had a really great experience through our friends at Montpelier. We are both helping to introduce a new online course there on the origins of the Constitution. And I'm sorry to say that, at least as of January of 2015, when we're speaking, the course is not quite yet available, but it's in process. And you and I and several other scholars and lawyers and other knowledgeable people went down to Richmond and we recorded some video. And that was fun, wasn't it?
It was a good time. It was very interesting to hear other people talk about the experiences of the early republic and forming the nation. Since, you know, I've obviously thought about it a whole lot, and it's always good to get other people's take because the emphases will be different, the perspectives and insights are different.
Right, and I think one of the things we were doing was double checking each other to make sure nobody screwed up. I don't recall any major gaffes occurring there. It was actually just a very collegial and fun time. We had fun joking around, and it was really, really fun.
It was, and we won't talk about the evening dinner.
I'll simply share with everyone that David has a lovely singing voice. Okay. Okay. Now, your latest book, as you've mentioned, is something called Madison's Gift. That's a fascinating title. But where's that come from?
Well, titles are always a bit of a chore for me, and my editor is actually brilliant at them, so she always throws out my titles. But this was collaborative, and we sort of kicked a bunch of things back and forth, and the notion was the book is really about what was special about Madison. He had this amazing impact on the nation by working with other people. And so as we kept going back and forth on it, one of us finally said, well, it was just his gift. And we thought, all right, then that'll do, and we can have a subtitle to explain it.
Madison's Gift. Well, it is. It's about several of these partnerships that he formed with people. And let's just give people an overview. Who are the five partners he had that you mentioned in your book?
They're rough chronological order. They're Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, and his wife, Dolly.
You know, of all of those, I'm thinking the one that might be the least familiar to people is James Monroe. But, they were practically neighbors, and they followed each other in the presidency, and they spent a lot of time together, didn't they?
They did. They really were friends. And although the great friendship of his life was with Jefferson, at some level, it felt from their correspondence that Madison and Monroe, were sort of easier with each other. They were more at the same stage of life. Although Jefferson was only 8 years older than Madison, he was a grandfather when Madison got married for the first time. So there was always a sense that Jefferson was senior, whereas Madison and Monroe dealt with each other more as contemporaries. Madison was the older brother, and I think their families were very close. So it was an important relationship to him, and one that we don't pay much attention to usually.
No, we don't, and I'm looking forward to that. But let's do this chronologically. Let's take the order that you took in your book and start with, I think you mentioned, Alexander Hamilton. What was the great thing about their relationship?
Well, what they shared most deeply was this passion for having America work as a constitutional republic. They came from very different worlds. Hamilton was an orphan from the West Indies who came essentially penniless to this country, extremely ambitious, incredibly talented, and, you know, clawed his way to the top by the time he was in his late 20s. He sought glory on the battlefield. He was a big, charismatic personality, although it was about Madison's size, frankly, physically.
You know, you mentioned that, David, and that proves a thesis, I think, that I've long held, and that is that the very best constitutional scholars are short.
I certainly have no data to contradict you.
Okay.
Madison was a child of privilege. His father owned a 5,000-acre plantation in Virginia, and, you know, Madison didn't have to work at all and was a quiet person and was his lack of charisma was perhaps his most significant political trait. So they were very different in their backgrounds and their personalities, but they saw in each other similar talents. They both were, frankly, incredibly smart. And they both had this amazing commitment to making the American experiment work. And so they made common cause for a number of years and with extraordinary effect.
Yeah, sometimes people will say that they represented two opposite extremes of the early American party system. And that's true. I mean, later on when Hamilton was guiding the Federalists and Madison was one of the leaders of the Democratic Republicans, that was true. But early on, these guys were both, in some sense, Federalists, and they worked together very closely. Did they first meet? The first meeting I'm aware of between them was at Annapolis in 1786. But does it go back even further than that?
Indeed, it does. They served in the Confederation Congress together in 1782 and 1783. And they were the young men in the room. I think that was a bond between them. Clearly, in some of his notes, Madison gives vent to frustration with Hamilton when they disagreed. But they agreed more than they disagreed. And they developed a real working relationship out of that experience. You know, Hamilton was up in New York based in New York, and Madison was based in Virginia, so they wouldn't see each other except when they were doing business. But they really were kindred spirits on the issues that were before the country at that time.
Right. And of course, I mentioned the Annapolis Conference. Eventually, the two of them decided that the Articles of Confederation, which was the first constitution we operated under after independence, they weren't working well. And whose idea was it for them to get together and call the other colonies, excuse me, the other states together at Annapolis in 1786?
The call for the Annapolis Conference grew out of a negotiation between Maryland and Virginia over the Potomac River, which happened at Mount Vernon. That negotiation happened in Mount Vernon, and it really was Washington who had been served as host, and Madison who carried the water to call the next stage, and that was moved through the Virginia legislature. That's where the call came from, or the Virginia Assembly is what it was called at the time. And the Annapolis meeting is often viewed as a footnote in history, and I think it really was terribly important, both because Madison and Hamilton really became allies at that moment, and because what they did was audacious. It didn't have to happen. Basically, they got to Annapolis, the attendance was lousy. They just threw up their hands and said, "Oh, the heck with it. We're going to stop pretending that we're just amending the Articles of Confederation or that we're just working at the edges. We need to start over." And they issued a call for what became the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And they said, basically, we need a convention to address all of the problems America faces. And that was just a huge step. It was very courageous, and they made it work.
So two of the youngest guys in the room at a meeting which has already failed because they can't get that many states even to show up in Annapolis to fix the Articles of Confederation, these guys get together and they say, "We're going to take the lead. We're going to fix this." That is audacious.
It is. Both men were close to Washington. Hamilton had been his aide during the war. Madison had made himself Washington's closest ally at that point, closest political ally. And so they obviously were betting on Washington as the great hero of the nation to get them across the finish line on this one, but they staked their lives and their reputations on taking that chance.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with lawyer and author David O. Stuart about his new book, Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with David O. Stuart. Stick around. Thank you.
Well, Doug, I'm feeling somewhat quizzical today.
Quizzical.
Do you have a quiz for us, or do you have a riddle?
No, I've got a quiz for you.
You've got a quiz for us. Well, that's a good thing. Do we have a contestant?
This is Paul.
Oh.
From Fremont, California.
Paul from Fremont, California.
The left coast.
We're so very, very happy to have you all the way from California. Are you ready to be quizzed, Paul?
Yes, sir.
Tremendous. Okay, Doug, have at him.
Hi, Paul. Well, I've got a question, and today the question is about executive power.
Mm.
So presidential power.
Very much in the news these days.
Very much in the news, isn't it? A lot of people talking about executive power.
Yeah.
We might get to that in a second. So, Paul, here's the question. I'm going to read it out to you, and I'm going to give you four choices. Tell you what, I'll give you five choices because I like you, Paul.
Okay.
What can the president do? Can the president raise taxes? Can the president borrow and spend money?
No.
Can the president set marriage and divorce laws?
No.
Can the president declare war?
Or, no.
Or E, none of the above?
Which one he's going to pick?
Well, Paul, you're not as much fun as some of our other contestants. I've got to tell you, generally speaking, there's this crescendo of intrigue that we're supposed to get to. But
Paul, you've robbed us of any sense of suspense at all.
You're exactly right.
The answer is E, none of the above. Correct. Very well done, Paul. How did you know all that stuff?
Well, you listed all the things Congress can do, I believe. I think it was Congress, and except for one that was a court's question.
Yeah, the court's question was about marriage, set marriage and divorce laws, and it's really not a court's question. It's a state's question.
Mm-hmm.
States set marriage and divorce laws.
Well, but the courts have gotten involved. They certainly have gotten involved.
Yeah, of course.
Well, you just nailed those, Paul, and you even have a really good explanation, because those were basically just straight out of Article 1. Those were mostly congressional powers, weren't they?
They are. They're mostly congressional powers or state powers.
Of course.
That's correct.
It just so happens that I read Article 1 just the other day.
You are a scholar, sir. You're a scholar. And of course, we've had a great...
I don't know about that.
Well, you certainly sound like one. We've had a lot of discussion about executive power lately.
We have. You know, there's a lot of talk about the president taking some executive powers into his own hands, both at the international level, which generally speaking, we've seen an increase. I think everyone on the political spectrum would agree. Mm-hmm. Executive power has increased since the time of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Around international issues, that's almost worthy of debate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a much more complicated world mm-hmm. now than it was during the time of Washington. But now we're actually starting to see the president expanding executive powers in ways that are domestic. And so that's having us go back and read about how other presidents have expanded domestic executive powers
mm-hmm.
as well.
So. Yeah, most presidents do, of course, at some point or another, push the envelope. At least 20th century presidents,
particularly
have.
In the second term.
Yeah, they push them. And right now, of course, the controversy du jour is over immigration and whether the president is gone too far with his executive authority. And of course, we're not going to resolve that issue today. But it's interesting how these subjects keep coming up again and again.
Well, you know, President Obama has taken quite a bit of heat within his own party as well. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia
mm-hmm.
Has said, no, we actually need this debate in Congress about whether to go after ISIL or not, whether we can use current executive war power resolutions mm-hmm. to justify that. Do we enter into a period where there's an unnamed enemy that the president is to go after, and that kind of gives carte blanche to trot the globe going after bad guys?
Mm-hmm.
The debate isn't whether these are bad guys or not, but whether the president has the power to do this without the authority of Congress. And of course, what Congress will inevitably do is say, well, our options, I guess, could be purse strings.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, when you go back and you look at the executive powers debate at the convention through Madison's notes of the debate, what you see is there's actually a tremendous amount of consensus that anything related to declaring war or making war really needs to go through the Congress.
Well, the starting point in any event is exactly where Paul took us, and that is to look at the actual text of the Constitution and see which branch is supposed to have these powers. And though that doesn't always answer the question, it is certainly the starting point. So, Paul, very well done in identifying the correct answer here and grounding it right in the text of the Constitution. So give us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size and your home address, and we'll have one in the mail to you.
Can you repeat the email again, sir?
Sure. ywc@montpelier.org. www.ecoalliance.org.
Will do.
Thank you. And thanks very much to you. Sure, actually. Thanks for you, Doug.
Sure, no problem. Stuart, you know, this is interesting. Do you remember back a couple of years ago, there was a debate about the federal budget and how to balance the federal budget?
Sure. And we've been debating that since the revolution. Yeah,
it's not how to balance the budget, but there was actually talk about the president minting like a $1 trillion coin.
Oh, Paul Krugman and the $1 trillion. We did a whole episode on that some time ago. Yes, we do. Yes, that's a fascinating issue.
You know, that is.
Well, we got to end this quiz now. You just keep
exactly
talking, Doug.
I just love seeing you.
I love seeing you too.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author David O. Stewart about his brand new book. It's just coming out. It's called Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America. It's a great tale all about James Madison's gift of getting along with other people and getting stuff done. Now, before the break, we were talking about one of the things that Madison did with his first partner in the book, at least, Alexander Hamilton, and that was getting George Washington on board for the Constitutional Convention.
Who took the lead in that lobbying?
Madison did a lot of it. Some others chimed in as well, because it was just known. Frankly, I think they probably believed that the Annapolis Conference failed because Washington wasn't there. And if Washington showed up, it would be real. It would be important. He was the person Americans trusted. He had done this amazing thing at the end of the war. He had been head of our army. He had won this brilliant victory. And he had walked away from power. You know, who does that in history? Almost nobody. And there's no better way to earn trust than to give up power. Washington had done it, so if he was willing to support something, it had just an almost incalculably better chance of succeeding.
Okay, so Washington goes to Philadelphia, and as we all know, the convention was a success. How did Madison and Hamilton collaborate during this time?
Well, at the convention, they couldn't collaborate very much. Hamilton was part of this hideously dysfunctional New York delegation, which there were only three delegates, and the other two thought Hamilton was from Mars. They disagreed with every opinion he had. Hamilton took rather aggressive positions on some of the issues before them. He argued that the president should serve for life, that senators should serve for life. It all looked like a lot of aristocracy and even monarchy to the other delegates. Hamilton ended up being there for only half the days they met and really didn't have much influence. So that was not sort of a halcyon period of their alliance, because Hamilton really got kicked to the sideline.
Was he absent because he was so angry with, I think they were Yates and Lansing, weren't they, the other two delegates?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Was it because he was going back to New York and lobbying George Clinton, or did he simply have other duties like his law practice or his family that he was seeing to?
He went back to see his family and look after his law practice, but if he'd been able to function in Philadelphia, I'm sure he would have stayed. And once his colleagues left, and he was willing to stay there and fight with them for the whole summer, but once his colleagues left, the rules of their delegation was that you had to have at least two delegates there. He was there by himself, so he couldn't even vote. He was completely neutered as a force in the convention, and he was so frustrated he left. He did come back. He came back a couple of times and was there at the end. His commitment to the enterprise was remarkable. On the last day, he says, "I couldn't disagree with this Constitution more, but it's the best we have, and I will fight for it." And that was what he did with Madison afterwards.
And we'll get to that in a moment. But before we do, and I know this for personal fact because I have actually been to the National Archives, he signed that document. He's a guy who can't even vote.
Yeah.
So where did he get the audacity for that?
It's great. He was that kind of guy. And George Washington, he kept a diary, and he writes in his diary on the day they signed, September 17, the Constitution was signed today by 11 states and Colonel Hamilton, because, you know, Hamilton had no business being there. He was just saying, you know, I really am going to be here. He was, I think, still trying to drag his state, New York, along with him. And, you know, this was, he knew the train was leaving the station and he wanted to be on it.
And indeed, he jumped right back on it when he got back to New York. You were about to tell me about his great collaboration on The Federalist with Madison and Jay. Please tell me more.
Yeah, the ratification of the Constitution is often thought of as sort of a rote thing that happened and just mechanical, no big deal. But in fact, it was quite a struggle. In several of the states, you needed 9 states to ratify for it to take effect. And New York was where the anti-federalists, the anti-constitution forces were really at their strongest. So very quickly, within a month of the release of the Constitution, Hamilton came up with the idea of having a series of newspaper essays to advocate for it. And that was the format in which most political discourse happened in America at this time. The newspapers were the only way to reach a lot of people. You didn't have mass media other than newspapers, and people were so spread out and lived in so many rural settings that it was only the newspapers that might ultimately get there to inform people. So he initially thought he would this would take 25 essays. He set up an outline for it. And he tried to recruit people. He recruited John Jay of New York, and Jay did ultimately write 5, but he had health issues and couldn't do more than that. Hamilton tried to recruit a couple of other New Yorkers who didn't work out. Either he thought their stuff wasn't any good or they just didn't produce. And finally, he turned to Madison, who was not a New Yorker. And Madison really pitched in. It took them a while to hit their stride, but they ultimately wrote, instead of 25, which is what Hamilton initially projected, they wrote 85. And
jeez Louise.
Yeah, well, once they got started, you know, they would do 3 or 4 a week.
Yeah, I've heard stories about Hamilton writing some of these when he was on the ship going up the Hudson River to Albany. I've heard of him writing them and handing them page by page to the printer, who would then run straight down and typeset them and print them off.
Yes, both recalled having the printer at their shoulder as they were writing. It was a very intense process. And one of the interesting things is there were 2 stretches where it was a solo, where there was one stretch where Madison had to write 20 in a row and another stretch where Hamilton wrote 20 in a row. So imagine the intensity of that. You're just, you know, out on an ice floe doing it yourself. But they ended up producing remarkable works. You know, they're young men still. Madison's 37, Hamilton's 33. And it stands as probably the finest work of political analysis, political philosophy that America has produced. And, you know, they cranked it out in six months as part of a propaganda campaign,
and still still often cited today. It's a very, very important work. Sometimes it's called the Federalist Papers. Could you tell me a little bit about how scholars have figured out who wrote which one? Because of course they were all signed by Publius. They didn't take individual credit. How do we know, or how do we think we know, which ones were Madison's and Jay's and Hamilton's?
Well, Hamilton created a list, which he had stashed in one copy of the book. They were bound. He had them bound at the end of the campaign. And that was found after he was killed by Aaron Burr. So that became the accepted attribution list. And Madison was pretty miffed, because there were 6 or 7 that he thought Hamilton had claimed that he hadn't written and that Madison had written. And he was generous in what he wrote. He said this clearly was an inadvertent mistake. Mr. Hamilton would not make this sort of mistake on purpose. But he did also insist that he had written them. And I think most scholars agree now with Madison's version of the list. And I love this. They use software to figure out the prevalence of certain words and certain sentence structures to demonstrate that it must have been Madison and not Hamilton.
Yeah, actually, I remember reading about that some years ago, and literally they would figure out who was more likely to use the word on versus the word upon.
Yeah.
And okay, so if it was upon, then it had to be Hamilton or it had to be Madison. And so those analyses largely confirmed Madison's correction of Hamilton's list.
Yes, and it's the sort of analysis that as long as everybody who does it agrees, I'll accept it.
I understand. Well, you know, I'm noticing the clock already, David, and I'm seeing that we're spending an awful lot of time in this one collaboration, but it's so fascinating. Maybe this will have to serve as an exemplar of some of the other things that you talked about in your book, because I don't want to leave Hamilton until we talk about the falling out that happened between him and Madison.
Yes. One of the sort of three things you have to deal with in Madison's career when you write about Madison is 1791, which is when he parts company from Hamilton and really from President Washington as well. The government's been up and running for 2 years. The first year or so, Madison is really the dominant influence over President Washington. But then Hamilton comes into office as Secretary of the Treasury, comes in with his plans for repaying the debt, for setting up the Bank of the United States, and he alienates Madison, not personally, but on the merits, on the policies. Madison doesn't like any of this. And I tried to explore that, what was bothering him so much. And I think a lot of it was we had a real outburst of speculation. We had some bubbles and some crashes, maybe two or three in about a two-year period. We've been through that just a few years ago. We know how painful those can be. And Madison just thought Hamilton's management of the government's financial business was not what it should be. And he moved somewhat gradually but firmly into opposition. And by the end of 1791, he has been the leader of the administration forces. He's sometimes referred to as the prime minister to President Washington in Congress. There's no question that he is no longer fulfilling that role by early 1792, and he's really becomes the leader of the opposition. So it's a big change. Hamilton is hurt by this. It's interesting. He writes a long letter to a person it's not clear he knew that well, about how hurt he was and how he can't figure it out. He attributes it to the satanic influence of Thomas Jefferson over Madison's mind. But that is a huge move in Madison's political outlook and his role, and it is something that you have to figure out if you're going to write about James Madison.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author David O. Stewart about his remarkable new book, Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America. I'm sorry that we're only going to get a chance to talk about a couple of those partnerships. So far, we've talked about Alexander Hamilton, and now it's all about Thomas Jefferson. After the break, we'll come back and speak some more with David O. Stewart. I was about to say we'd start with our Madison Minute, but you know, today that seems kind of superfluous. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with author David O. Stewart about his new book, Madison's Gift, Five Partnerships That Built America.
You know, I always had a theory, and I've been told I'm wrong more than once, so I'll let you tell me I'm wrong, too. And that is that, you know, Thomas Jefferson was not at the Constitutional Convention. He was over in France. And sure. He didn't come back until President Washington appointed him as our first Secretary of State. And even then, he took his time. So he shows up around this time. And I always had the impression that, you know, Madison greets him at the dock and Jefferson gets off and says, "What have you done?" and woodsheds Madison. And that Madison then, at that point, almost with his tail between his legs, you know, becomes more of a Jeffersonian. Of course, that's a little oversimplified. Is there any evidence that something like that happened, though, that Jefferson came back and that he finally expressed his reservations? Or was it more like you described it, simply Madison and Hamilton disagreeing on the merits?
Jefferson expressed his reservations about the Constitution in letters from France throughout, including letters to Madison. He complained that there was no Bill of Rights. He described the president as a poor imitation of the Polish king. I mean, it was unmistakable to anybody that he was not happy with the Constitution. Indeed, during the Virginia Ratifying Convention, the opponents of the Constitution cited Jefferson as their authority for why it was a bad Constitution. And Madison actually said, I take a second place to nobody in respecting that individual, but after all, he wasn't here in Philadelphia, so he doesn't really know what we did, which is, you know, a fairly salty response. And to be honest, when he wrote back to Jefferson, you know, he said it very courteously, but he basically said, you know, you weren't here, you don't know what happened there, and you don't understand what we had to do. So this notion that Jefferson sort of slapped him around and brought him to heel, I've always found silly. When there, that may have come out more harshly than I should have.
Oh, no, no. I think it's sort of a silly story, too. I just thought it was kind of funny to think about. And I guess what I'm saying is that that's a common perception. And so I've always wondered to what extent that was true and that there was actually some sort of confrontation at dockside or soon after Jefferson got back. But you're about the third or fourth person to tell me that that common perception is wrong.
Yeah, I think they fell into each other's arms. They were so glad to see each other. And honestly, Madison, for their whole lives together, and you know, they were close friends for 40 years, never had any trouble telling Jefferson that he was wrong. He always said it in a polite way. But their correspondence is full of Madison saying, you know, by the way, you need to rethink this. So this notion that he's somehow the handmaiden of Jefferson, or as John Randolph called him, his mistress.
Didn't Patrick Henry call him Mr. Jefferson's creature?
I don't recall that, but it would be consistent. And, you know, Henry hated both of them. So it was easy to do. You have the physical situation where Jefferson's a foot taller and Madison's the quiet guy and Jefferson's the charming guy. You would always see him as the dominant figure. I think that's a misperception. He certainly was a powerful personality and an important guy, but they were partners. They were not master and servant.
Okay, well, we seem to be segueing naturally into a discussion of that most important of his relationships, that one with Jefferson. But any final thoughts on Hamilton before we talk about Thomas Jefferson?
Now, the one thing I would say is, you know, Hamilton and Jefferson hated each other. Washington and Jefferson ended up really disliking each other. And one of the striking things about Madison was he ends up in opposition to Washington and Hamilton. And Washington and Hamilton still won't say a bad thing about him. Indeed, after Madison's been leading the opposition for 3 years in Congress to President Washington, Washington tries to appoint a minister to France. So he had the ability to disagree without being disagreeable, which is pretty noteworthy.
An extremely important trait, and one that I wish we had more of in today's politics, but I digress. tell me, David, about this most important of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's always been my perception that that is the most important, at least politically and constitutionally, the most important relationship that Madison had was with Mr. Jefferson.
Absolutely. And I think personally, except for Dolly, Jefferson was the most important figure. Yes.
Okay. Well, where did that begin? How did those two fellows meet each other?
Well, they had met in the Virginia state government during the Revolution when there was a constitutional convention and Madison was 25, just a whippersnapper, and Jefferson was a more senior figure. And then Jefferson was governor and Madison was on his executive council during the Revolution. So they had some connection, but it was at they were both young enough that the eight-year age difference, I think, meant more than it came to mean. As you get older, those age differences become less.
For example, I mean, I really like you, even as old as you are.
your generosity of spirit is just marvelous.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I felt that in about 1783, they spent several periods together in Philadelphia, just the two of them, basically. At one period, Jefferson had his oldest daughter with him. And I just felt that they became – that's a moment when they become personally the best of friends.
All right. And so that's in 1783, but they'd actually collaborated a little bit before that in some very important ways, hadn't they? I'm thinking of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom?
That was actually, if I have the sequence right, Jefferson had drafted that before then.
Right. I think it was 1779 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
It had been proposed.
Yeah, and I don't recall Madison being much of a factor in that.
Okay.
Where getting it enacted was the key step, where they did collaborate some, but it was really Madison who got it adopted through the assembly. And that is a bit of their pattern through life, which is Jefferson has the idea and Madison figures out how to make it happen. And that certainly happened there. And they both took immense pride in that first statement of religious freedom.
Could you tell us a little bit about that statute and about how Madison got it passed?
Well, it was, I've already alluded to the fact that their great nemesis in Virginia politics was Patrick Henry, and Patrick Henry wanted to establish a system. This is after the Revolution, just a year or two after, and a system of state support for what we would call today the Episcopal clergy. And this appalled Madison, and he and Jefferson essentially went to the mattresses over it, to use an anachronistic term.
I like the Godfather movies, too.
Yeah, well, they were great. So Jefferson ends up over in France when this finally comes to a head, and writes a wonderful letter where he says, well, as to Mr. Henry, I suppose the only thing we can do is wait for him to die. But Jeff Madison was not of the same mind. He thought he could persuade people and get his legislation, or Jefferson's legislation, this statute of religious tolerance, enacted. So he not only thwarts Henry's move to impose state to establish state support for the clergy, he actually gets the statute of religious tolerance through the assembly. It's an extraordinary legislative achievement.
And there was quite a lot of maneuvering. That's another thing, of course, Madison was very famous for. He got things put off. He got himself a little breathing room. He wrote his very famous document, the Memorial and Remonstrance,
yes,
against religious assessments, which is a very accessible document. It's very short, so if anyone wants to Google it and read it for himself, it takes 15 minutes. And it's very important. And that, to me, that episode, as you say, really epitomizes how well the two of them worked together to achieve important ends.
They respected each other and understood each other's talents and limitations, and they were a phenomenal partnership for many, many years.
All right. So we're still in the 1780s, though, and then, of course, Jefferson goes off to France. They correspond, very important correspondence. Pick up the story at the next important juncture, if you would, please.
It really is when Hamilton is falling out of love with Madison is falling out of love with Hamilton in Washington in 1791. His obvious ally with this is Jefferson, who was Secretary of State. And it takes a period of years, but they begin forming a political party. It starts with the coalition in Congress of like-minded people. They start calling themselves the Republican Interest. It evolves.
We have to make the correction. No relationship to the modern Republican Party.
Absolutely.
In fact, they called themselves, if I recall, one of them, was it Madison who wanted to call them the Democratic Party, and Jefferson who wanted to call them the Republican Party, so they ended up compromising on the Democratic Republicans?
The name was a bit changeable over the early years.
Right.
And it did evolve. And its descendant is the Democratic Party, although you can't really claim a ideological identity between those either.
Right. Just in a historical sense. You can trace a line, but obviously the position of that original party's changed a lot over the years.
The world has changed, exactly.
Indeed it has.
So they start with a congressional coalition. It evolves into connections with newspapers, essentially allied and even sponsored newspapers. And then finally, political operatives emerge in key states. And by the election of 1800, they really are sitting on top of what is a party. And it's something the framers of the Constitution didn't intend, didn't anticipate. And frankly, if you were to tell Madison and Jefferson that they had founded the nation's first political party, they would wince with sort of embarrassment, But of course they did, because they discovered that only a party structure would allow them to summon public opinion to oppose the policies of Hamilton and Washington that they disagreed with.
And we have to note the great irony that one of the reasons that one of the justifications that Madison gave, indeed, I believe in the Federalist Papers more than one place, was that a vast geographic area for this new republic would reduce the influence of what he called factions. And, you know, and he formed the first national faction, in a sense.
Well, there is that. You can dig into that a little bit. He was really talking about, at one level, he was talking about interest groups, creditors and debtors, farmers and tradesmen, different religious sects, and not thinking in terms of broad political parties when he wrote about how the factions would cancel each other out. He really wasn't thinking there would be political parties. And I think he thought of his political party as spanning many factions. But you're right. What he said in the Federalist was not exactly how things worked out.
Well, that's politics now, isn't it? Alrighty, so they form their party. This takes place, of course, during the Washington administration, and as it continues on through the Adams administration. What happened next?
The big event is the election of 1800.
But before we get there, can I ask, would you talk about the Alien and Sedition Acts and the relationship between Adams and Jefferson?
Well, yes, and that's the framework of the election of 1800.
Okay, please.
You get into what's called the Quasi-War with France. There is a falling out between America and France. There is combat on the high seas. And our Navy ships actually are fighting with French Navy ships. And there's an upsurge in great patriotic spirit. And Congress is in the hands of the Federalist Party at this time, and they adopt the Alien and Sedition Acts. The opponents of this militaristic response to France are often considered aliens, and so that's why you have the alien piece. But the really controversial piece of it was the Sedition Act, which created a crime of making any statement that would call the president or Congress or the government into disrepute. And if you had that statute in place today, for example, Stephen Colbert and John Stewart would be in jail because virtually everything they say calls the president, Congress, or the government into disrepute.
Yeah.
And people recognized immediately that this was a remarkable extension of power, throttling of public voices, and the Adams administration went out and started prosecuting newspaper editors and throwing them into jail. Jefferson and Madison detested this. They responded very aggressively through the only mechanism they could find in the political world at the time. The Federalists controlled the presidency, Congress, the courts. So they turned to state governments, and they drafted what were adopted in Virginia and Kentucky, these resolutions denouncing the sedition and Alien and Sedition Acts, but also asserting a state's right to oppose or obstruct federal policy, which was very controversial then, remains very controversial 200 and some years later. There are differences in shading, fascinating differences, if you care. And I do.
We did a whole episode on nullification and the Virginia and Kentucky resolution. So, yeah, you're right. This is not really nullification by a state.
It isn't. And the Kentucky resolution, which Jefferson wrote, goes a little farther. And the Virginia resolution is more careful. Madison writes a year later the Report of 1800 for Virginia, which actually is even a little less aggressive. So what they said was used by the secessionists in the Civil War and even the people who opposed integration in the 1950s, but I think has been overstated and distorted some.
Right, and more, we have to remember the context. The Alien and Sedition Acts were, and I'm a great admirer of John Adams, but they were the low point of his career and the death knell, perhaps, of the entire Federalist Party. It's almost inconceivable to me how people in the founding generation could have so thoroughly undermined the idea of free expression and free political expression. It's just, it's a very dark period in our history. And so that's the sort of extreme federal behavior that might justify states at least protesting.
It is. And I always feel it incumbent upon me to add, though, the Jefferson administration also threw newspaper publishers into jail, but they did it under state libel statutes, which they somehow viewed was less restrictive of free speech.
And now you're going to talk about New York Times versus Sullivan. Okay, Dave, we got to stay chronological.
Right.
Okay, in fact, we're running short on time, so let's skip a little bit forward. One thing I noticed that you talk about in your book that I was not really that much aware of was that once Jefferson did win the election of 1800, Madison helped him out in one of his more controversial and arguably extra-constitutional actions, and that was the Louisiana Purchase.
Yes. Of course, Madison was Secretary of State, was in charge of the diplomacy of the new nation, or of the nation at that point. And so he was part of the instructions that went with James Monroe when he went to France. And when the purchase materials come back, Jefferson and Madison are elated at the prospect of acquiring all this land. But they do know that the Constitution actually has no provision that authorizes this. And they worry about it a little bit, and then they just decide, oh, what the heck, you know, this is really good stuff.
Right.
And
opportunities don't come along that frequently to double your national area.
Yeah, and there is sort of a national consensus that we will look away. we won't pay any attention to this. And so everybody just agreed not to worry about it.
I'm really, really sorry, but we're going to have to wind this up. But I'm going to give you one last opportunity to just sort of grandly summarize Madison's gift for partnership with other people.
He had an ability to not need the credit, to check his ego at the door, to focus on what needed to be done, to work with other people, to listen to them, and to find ways to move forward. He could do it with very different personalities. He could do it in very different situations. And if the partnership no longer was consistent with his political beliefs, he wouldn't just stick around for friendship. He and Hamilton parted ways. He and Washington parted ways. But it was never bitter. He had this gift of connecting with people, which is, you know, for a small man with a small voice who was uncomfortable in crowds, turned out to be a very powerful gift.
And, of course, that's the basic title of your book, Madison's Gift. What's the subtitle?
The five partnerships that built America.
Tremendous. And when is the book going to be available so we can all run out and buy 15 copies?
February 10th.
February 10th, 2015. It'll be available on Amazon, I'm sure, and in bookstores on your local corner.
God, I hope so.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to David O. Stewart. Make sure you go out and buy his new book, Madison's Gift. It's just fabulous, like all of his books are. In fact, buy all of his books. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. The Madison Minute, even though we didn't have one today, is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock, who always brushes his teeth after meals. We recently did a show on a controversy in the Goochland County Public Schools, and Sherry Heiter of Bristol, Virginia, corrected my pronunciation. It's not Goochland, it's Goochland. That's Goochland. Thanks, Sherry. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.